And so let's open our Bibles to the 11th chapter of Daniel. And we're going to begin, we're going to pick up this evening where we left off last Wednesday evening at verse 30. Now, I have up on the screen, and I will have a printout of this next series of slides next Wednesday evening. But I have verses 21 through 45 up here, and that corresponds with our brief outline that we've presented for the 11th chapter of Daniel. And for verses 21 through 45, we have been connecting those with the Seleucid ruler Antiochus Epiphanes. However, as we're going into this last part of the 11th chapter, I want you to know that there is some variant thinking on verses 36 through verse 45. There are probably some four or five different major interpretations of who verses 36 through 45 are really referring to. And some of them are, as we could say, way out in left field. Okay? One of them happens to be an Arabic name I can't even pronounce. One of them being the Antichrist. But what you should know is that some of the alternate thinking on verses 36 through verse 45 is that that section of verses refer to Rome. But I don't think so far that Mickey and I together have really come to that conclusion. So that's why so far we have talked about verses 21 through 45 as referring to Antiochus Epiphanes, but some do think that verses 36 through 45 have reference to Rome and Caesar. Okay? Now, we're going to see in this section of verses, and in particular, what we're going to be dealing with immediately in this class, maybe into next Wednesday night, are verses 30 through 35. Okay? There's a lot of material there, and I'm not quite certain that all of that material in verses 30 through 35 perhaps follows exactly a record of secular history in terms of when the events happened. Okay? But in particular, in verses 30 through 35, I believe we're going to see repeated the theme that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom He will. And that's the English Standard Version rendering. And that's in the fifth chapter of Daniel and verse 21. And in that context, in verse 21 in Daniel chapter 5, who was being referred to there in that immediate context? That the Most High God rules in the kingdoms of men. Who learned that lesson the hard way? Nebuchadnezzar. What did you say, David?
A lot of people.
A lot of people. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Belshazzar knew this, but he disregarded the hard-learned lesson of Nebuchadnezzar, and you can see that in verse 22. He was, as the text says, he was therefore weighed in the balances. And so all who live with a disregard of the Most High God are found wanting, as we learn in verse 27 of chapter 5. And the Babylonian captivity really furnished the context for this message. Daniel the prophet, in the way that Jesus referred to him in Matthew 24 and 15, recorded events and prophecies in the book of Daniel to demonstrate the truth that God is in control of the affairs of men and the nations of men. We're going to see this in verses 30 through 35. To accomplish his purpose, and perhaps in verse 35, according to his divine timetable. We're going to see these themes repeated in verses 30 through 35. Okay. Let's all focus our attention on verse 30. Randy, would you read verse 30 for us?
Just 30?
Yeah.
For ships of Kittim will come against him, therefore he will be disheartened, and will return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant.
Okay. Kittim is a Hebrew reference to Cyprus and all the lands west of Cyprus. And what I found interesting in my research is that this was apparently so well understood by those who translated LXX. And does anyone know what LXX refers to, Randy? The Septuagint. Okay. And the Septuagint is? The Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, and the work on that was done in approximately the 3rd and 2nd centuries before the birth of Christ in Alexandria. So, I found it interesting that the Septuagint actually translated regarding those who are going to come against him in ships as, and the Romans will come. That's how the Septuagint reads. Now, what Randy read in verse 30 is, I believe your version said, and he will be grieved.
He will be disheartened.
And what are you reading from?
New American Standard.
New American Standard. Oh, he will be grieved as New King James. Okay. And also the American Standard. Okay, he will be disheartened. He will be grieved. Now, as the story goes about Rome coming against Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes had gone into Egypt and had conquered virtually everything in Egypt except Alexandria. And Rome was very concerned about this because the empire was afraid that Antiochus would interfere with the routine supply of grain from Egypt to Rome. And so, the Roman Laenas was sent by the Roman Senate, and he carried instructions or carried a demand to Antiochus that Antiochus quit the land or leave Egypt. Donna? Yes. That's his name.
Oh, it's his name?
Yes. Okay. Actually, I just used his last name. He has about three names in a row. As the story goes, Antiochus hesitated, didn't want to give an answer, and Laenas drew a circle around Antiochus in the sand and said, "Before you step out of this circle, I must have an answer." So he put Antiochus on the spot, and remember, Antiochus had been a hostage in Rome. He knew about Roman culture. He knew about the might of Rome. So, he knew that he would have to meet the Romans in war if he didn't provide an answer before he stepped out of the circle.
Terry?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt. Just trying to make sense out of what you've got written here. They appraised him of the demand of the Senate that he quit the land. Are we saying that Linus went to Antiochus and said, "Rome wants you out of Egypt"?
Linus went to Egypt. This takes place in Egypt.
And said, "Get out of here."
And said, "Quit the land. Get out of here. Leave Egypt. You and your whole army." Okay. And history records, maybe I should have put quotes around that, but that Antiochus was thoroughly vexed and agitated. So he was disheartened, as one version renders it. And he had to give his word that he would withdraw from Egypt immediately. And he was in a rage about this. And Randy, would you reread verse 30?
"For ships of Kittim will come against him. Therefore he will be disheartened and will return and
okay.
So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant."
He will be enraged at the Holy Covenant. Okay. Antiochus was in a rage, and he couldn't have Egypt. So this left, he was exposed on the southern end of his empire. So he felt like he had to control Palestine if Egypt was to remain unconquered by him and to remain a rival power to him. So he found it more necessary than ever to retain his hold on Palestine. So he dispatched one of his generals, Apollonius, to occupy the city of Jerusalem. So I think perhaps we do see a fulfillment there that he would return in rage to the Holy Covenant. Randy?
Still trying to get my mind around this. Do you still have the map?
Yeah.
Antiochus, was he the northern king?
Antiochus was the Seleucid king, of the northern kingdom, the northern king.
So he's already, now at this point, he's conquered the southern kingdom, which was...
Which was Egypt, the Ptolemies.
The Ptolemies are out of the picture now.
Virtually.
Antiochus has Egypt. But when Rome says, get out of Egypt...
That leaves the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies did survive this, yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, what it ended up was two brothers ended up ruling Egypt. Two Ptolemy brothers. Richard?
I was going to say that in this right here, Antiochus had driven the armies of Egypt back almost to Alexandria.
Right.
And that's when Rome stepped in and said, mm-hmm. if you're not going to do this, get lost.
That's right.
So they booted him out of Egypt. Mm-hmm. And, given that would nominally mean that Rome was sort of in charge of Egypt from then on, though, like to say, they were still under self-rule, but if Rome could tell Antiochus to do this, that they were actually looking at Egypt themselves.
Yeah, I've wondered about that, and what would have happened if Antiochus had not gone into Egypt. I've tried to think about and speculate what would Rome have eventually come into Palestine, but that's just speculation. I was thinking in that mode simply because we see that God is in control of the nations, and He's used the nations to accomplish His purpose. And as we see in the second chapter of Daniel, there was certainly going to be a fourth world kingdom that was going to be used, that was going to assist the accomplishment of God's purpose. Richard? Right.
His dad, Antiochus III, mm-hmm. that attempted to recapture lands in Greece and was turned back by the Romans, or was it his grandfather? Somebody in his...
I think that was on Antiochus III.
So he attempted to recapture some lands in Greece. Mm-hmm. Rome turned him back from there. And now his son is trying to recapture, as it were, lands in Egypt, and Rome turns him back from there. Rome sort of got him in a pincer movement now. And
that is beginning.
Mm-hmm. Out toward India, but this, I think, is the
That's true.
Beginning of the end here.
Yes. Yes, this is starting to be the beginning of the end for Antiochus Epiphanes. But before we get to the end, there's a great deal in the story. So the Seleucid general, Apollonius, does go to conquer Jerusalem. He returns in rage, meaning Antiochus, to the Holy Covenant, the land of Israel. And so what does he do? What does Apollonius do? In a Sabbath attack, when he knew that the Orthodox Jews would not fight, he slaughtered large numbers of Jews. And actually, the city walls were destroyed, and a new fortress, the Acra, was built on the site of the part of Jerusalem called the Citadel. Thank you. Now, well, actually, interestingly enough, I mean, this may not be generally known, but Antiochus went in and destroyed the walls of Jerusalem and built a fortress within the city of Jerusalem. And he garrisoned that fortress with Syrian troops. And Antiochus's forces were assisted by Menelaus and his apostate followers. Now, we see, as I've quoted up there, against the Holy Covenant, we see that in that part of the verse, verse 30, against the Holy Covenant, we see Antiochus coming in and conquering Jerusalem. And he's assisted by pro-Seleucid Jews. And by the way, there was a whole population of pro-Seleucid Jews. And an interesting side story. Someone in class here has described the 11th chapter of Daniel as somewhat like a soap opera. Well, interestingly enough, the high priest in Israel prior to Menelaus here was a high priest at this time. He had a brother named Jason. And notice these Greek names for these Jews, Jason and Menelaus, instead of Hebrew names. But Jason was the high priest, and Jason had originally gone to Antiochus Epiphanes and said, I'm going to give you this sum of money to be high priest. I want to buy the high priesthood office. And Antiochus said, of course. And Antiochus took the money. And then, sometime later on in this saga, Menelaus is sent by Jason, his brother, to pay tribute, monetary tribute, to Antiochus. And when Menelaus has an audience with Antiochus, Menelaus says, if you will oust my brother and make me high priest, I will give you an even larger sum of money. And Antiochus says, yes. And so he threw Jason out. And while Antiochus was in Egypt, and all that affair down there trying to conquer Egypt, and meeting with Rome, there was a rumor that circulated that Antiochus had died in Egypt. And so, Jason and led a revolt with about 1,000 or so Orthodox Jews, and caused Menelaus to flee from Jerusalem. And Antiochus, of course, kind of considered this an insult, because he had seated Menelaus as high priest. And so he didn't appreciate Jason undermining his authority. And that's why Menelaus and his group assisted Antiochus in conquering Jerusalem. Randy?
Are we up to the Maccabees yet? Is that...
No.
Okay. Jason's a different one.
Jason is a different one.
Was it Jason Maccabee?
I think there was. There were, in particular, there were five sons of Matthias, and I think in particular three of them are named. And Jason might have been one of the five, or one of the three named. We're not there yet. So Antiochus, you see, Antiochus did have regard to those pro-Seleucid Jews, like Jason, Menelaus, who would forsake the Holy Covenant. Donna? Pro-Seleucid Jews? Jews who were loyal to Antiochus and the Syrian Empire, the Seleucid Empire. They were pro... let me back up just a little bit and say that... Alexander the Great, was a different kind of conqueror. He didn't conquer just by the sword. Alexander the Great wanted to conquer by culture also, not just the sword. That's why he married a Persian princess by the name of Roxana. And I believe that this type of thinking filtered down through the generations of the Greek soldiers and the Greek generals. We see that Antiochus didn't just obtain this empire by a sword, but he obtained it by making alliances and intrigues. And maybe I'm not answering your question very well, but Donna, state your question again. Yeah. We see, Antiochus wanted to not just conquer by a sword, but he wanted to conquer by culture. As we're going to see later on, he issued edicts to Hellenize Palestine. In other words, to enforce and impress, to infiltrate Palestine with the Greek culture. Okay? He wanted to make Greeks out of the Jews. That was one way Antiochus was going to conquer the land, not just by the sword only. Randy?
We could come to the conclusion that he was successful because at the time of Christ, Greek was the main language of the land.
Koine Greek, yeah.
So he was successful, really.
And by the way, just as a sidebar, since you brought that up, you know, the language of the Septuagint was Koine Greek, as you're mentioning. But that is what eventually happened because of the Greek conquest. Yes, that a common language was spread and a common culture was spread, the Hellenistic culture. David? Right.
Wanted to do things the Hebrew way. And you had the war, and Randy would kind of lose it, coming up later, the Maccabean war. And they got rid of the Syrians out of there. And then in the Maccabean, they had to claim their own house, too. They got rid of the Seleucid Jews out of that, too. So it ended up, not totally got rid of them, but ended up.
But Donna, Antiochus wanted to impose, as we'll see, Greek culture on the Jews. Okay? That's not conquering only by a sword. As I was referring to it, that was conquering by changing the culture. Okay? And that was really the philosophy of Alexander the Great. That's what Alexander tried to accomplish. So Antiochus had regard unto those that had forsaken the Holy Covenant. Okay, and Antiochus would take military control of Jerusalem, especially the temple. Forces from him would appear. Randy, would you read verse 31?
31, and forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And they will set up the abomination of desolation.
Ah, yes, and the abomination of desolation. Okay, as we mentioned, Antiochus found it more than necessary to hold on to Palestine. He dispatched Apollonius to occupy the city of Jerusalem. We talked about the Sabbath attack. So forces from him shall appear. And he slaughtered large numbers of Jews. He would cause the sacrifices to cease and profane the temple and fortress, and shall take away the regular burnt offering. Verse 31. It's recorded that swine were sacrificed on the altar in the temple. The drunken parties, and this was part of the Greek culture, associated with the worship of the god Bacchus, were made compulsory by Antiochus. And on the other side of the coin, while he was doing this, he forbid the practice of circumcision. He forbid Sabbath observance and the observance of the feasts of the Jewish year. He couldn't celebrate the Passover or any of the three great Jewish festivals. So he would cause the sacrifices to cease. And he would set up the abomination that makes desolate. And here's where we're getting to what we discussed a few moments ago, Donna. He made a systematic attempt to Hellenize the country by force. He issued an edict throughout his empire regarding the fusion of all nationalities into one people. Greek deities were to be worshipped by all. And he even went so far as to send an Athenian philosopher to Jerusalem to supervise the enforcement of the order. And this Athenian identified the God of Israel with Zeus. And ordered a bearded image of Zeus, the pagan deity, set up upon the temple altar. And Syrian soldiers performed heathen rites in the very temple courts. So these are some of the things that Antiochus was having done. Now, I think we might have had from Mickey last week, if any of you recall, we might have had a little homework assignment. But before we get to that, and I know this is... Yeah,
so
Ken.
This bearded pagan, is it something he believed in?
Yeah.
So he did believe in it, just like it was a pagan god, he did believe in it?
Yeah.
I was kind of going over where he said that there were no
Oh, when you said he, you're talking about Antiochus?
Yeah. Oh.
Well, ultimately, Antiochus had the statue of Zeus put in the temple. It was Antiochus's representative, the Athenian philosopher, who had that set up in the temple. But as actually, as I understand from my research, Antiochus probably did not believe in any gods. Okay? He set himself up as God. As a matter of fact, one of his names actually translated into English means God made manifest. He called himself Theos Epiphanes. Now, let me... I know this is kind of small print, but I wanted to read this quote from 2 Maccabees chapter 6, verses 1 through 11 for some historical reference about this time, this particular time we're looking at in verse 31. Not long after the king sent an Athenian senator to force the Jews to abandon the customs of their ancestors and live no longer by the laws of God, also to profane the temple in Jerusalem and dedicate it to Olympian Zeus. So they're going to dedicate the temple to Zeus. And that on Mount Gerizim to Zeus, the hospitable, as the inhabitants of the place requested, they also brought into the temple things that were forbidden, so that the altar was covered with abominable offerings prohibited by the laws. A man could not keep the Sabbath or celebrate the traditional feasts, nor even admit that he was a Jew. At the suggestion of the citizens of Ptolemy, another city, a decree was issued ordering the neighboring Greek cities to act in the same way against the Jews, oblige them to partake of the sacrifices and put to death those who would not consent to adopt customs of the Greeks. It was obvious, therefore, that disaster impended. Thus, two women who were arrested for having circumcised their children were publicly paraded about the city with their babies hanging at their breasts and then thrown down from the top of the city wall. Others who had assembled in the nearby caves to observe the Sabbath in secret were betrayed to Philip and all burned to death. So these were the things that Antiochus was having done, the imposition of Greek culture on the Jews. Now, regarding verse 31, there's the phrase in there, the abomination of desolation. And I believe Mickey wanted the class to begin a little discussion regarding the abomination of desolation, and specifically is the abomination of desolation in Daniel 11:31 the same as the one mentioned in Daniel 12 and 11? That phrase is used in two chapters. I think so. Huh? I think so.
You know, Christ went in there three times to cleanse that, and finally he said, "Your house is what?
Mm-hmm. Made desolate." Now, well, we must have 5 minutes left.
Not much.
Okay. Okay. I'm sure when we get to the towards the end of the 12th chapter that we'll probably resurrect this discussion about the abomination of desolation. But David?
Yeah, if you've gone and read any of the stuff that you see online, and like I said, there are several different views on this. Of course, the premillennialists, there's like several different
ones. Right.
They don't have this one either. And of course, they have to come up with a much later explanation. Some of it's all the way up in the Nazis and other things. To match up with their timeline that we talked about back in the
ninth chapter.
How that they had that gap in there in that last week of reading later on. So they, I read some of them, some of the stuff on Nazis. A lot of it, and there's quite a few of them that have the later date philosophy, but most of them were, like, sort of several different ones, and all of them were premillennialists, so they don't agree on what the later date. Some of them were like 8400, a lot of stuff that went through 8400
through that time period. So there's a lot of it that goes over way past where I can see any
justification for
that
stuff. But there's a lot of discussion
about
the abomination,
the
desolation.
I think right now, at least the way I would answer this question is to actually reference Matthew 24:15. Jesus speaks of the abomination of desolation that Daniel the prophet spoke of in that verse. However, Jesus made it clear that he was referring to an event that had not yet occurred. Jesus is talking about the future, but would occur soon. And you can see that from the 34th verse of Matthew. That's Matthew 24:15 cannot be referring to Daniel 11:31, since the event predicted by Daniel 11:31, and this is in the context of what Antiochus Epiphanes did to maintain the context of the 11th chapter. That Daniel 11:31 came to pass before the birth of Christ. So, Randy?
Unless it happened twice. I'm just saying, there's many prophecies. Uh-huh.
Well, actually, I'll just phrase it this way. In a sense, I could say that it happened twice, but only in a very special sense. Okay? And we'll probably bring that up again in the 12th chapter. But the event being talked about in the 11th chapter of Daniel is in the timeline, the time frame of Antiochus Epiphanes, the event talked about in Daniel chapter 12, I believe, is what Jesus was referring to. And when Jesus made that statement, that was referring to something that was going to happen in the future. Okay? Yeah.
The passage in 12:11 seems to hearken back to chapter 9:27. Because in chapter 9, remember the last few verses of chapter 9 is talking about the Messiah, by name. It says the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed is poured out on one who makes desolate.
Mm-hmm.
So that would seem like that would also be...
Oh, it would seem like it would tie in with chapter 9. Right.
Yeah, Jesus would be making reference to that as well.
Okay, I want to thank everyone for the discussion this evening and for your attention.